You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome into a Monday edition of Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast that breaks down every Heat game, news item, rumor, and more. Thanks for listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on the brand new podcast app, Himalaya. My name is Wes Goldberg, and I'm here with David Ramil. And this is what we call Blue Notebook Monday, where in preparation for June's NBA draft, David and I each scout a different player, talk about if they'd be a good fit for the Heat, and just get in, just do a deep dive on that prospect. Then later on in the show, we'll talk about this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but that's coming up later on. Let's start with your draft prospect, David. Who did you spend the last week scouting?
I was looking at Rui Hachimura of Gonzaga. Or is it Gonzaga? I can never remember. I think it's Gonzaga.
Zaga.
It is Gonzaga. They're the Zags. Sorry, my apologies to any Gonzaga Bulldog fans out there. It is the Bulldogs. No, it's Zags. What am I talking about? There's so many Bulldogs.
No, Gonzaga Bulldogs.
It is a Gonzaga
Bulldogs. They call them but they also call them, they're like War Eagle. It's like Auburn, like choose a mascot. Right. I don't know how many Gonzaga fans we have on this podcast.
I'm sure there are plenty.
I don't know.
They're an up-and-coming school. Well, I'm sorry. They're not an up-and-coming school. They've been a good school when it comes to basketball.
I feel like you know nothing about Gonzaga, despite... Did you do any of the scouting homework?
I did not.
I feel like you know nothing about Gonzaga.
I know where it is. I know it's in Spokane, Washington.
There you go.
That's it. Look, Hachimura is an interesting prospect. He's 6'8", 230 pounds, played 3 years at Gonzaga. Let's get into the statistics a little bit here, because, again, with 3 years, I kind of wanted to go into all of them, but at the same time, maybe that's not such a good idea, and I'll explain that later on. As far as his junior year totals, he played in all 37 games, started all 37 games, shot 59% from the floor, 60% overall from two-point range, and then he was 15 of 36 on three-point attempts for, 42% from three-point range. Not bad. Shot 74% from the line. Solid rebounder, 6.5 rebounds per game. Not great passing, 1.5 assists per game, just under a steal and under a block per game. And not bad on turnovers either, just 1.8 turnovers per game either. So solid numbers overall, perhaps not great. And I think that's probably where the story comes in with Hachimura, is that, one, he didn't start playing basketball until he was 12. He's also born in Japan, from a Beninese father and a Japanese mother. And so basketball wasn't even his first choice. Baseball, obviously, being a big part of Japanese culture. And even in his own family, baseball was a big part of his own familial bond. So he didn't really take up basketball until later in life. Again, like I said, 12. But he had this growth spurt and decided it was a good idea for him to invest himself fully into this. So that's when basketball really took off for him. And I think it's still clearly under development in the country of Japan, and so I think Hachimura kind of struggles and suffers as a result of the lack of basketball development in Japan itself. So as far as his pros are concerned, really good athlete, incredible size, 7'2" wingspan. He's very, very strong. He absorbs contact really well. He's a good shooter, good form, slow, patient, methodical in his release, and obviously shoots really well from the free throw line. And he can draw fouls pretty well, so that's all positives as far as his ability to translate his talents to the next level. As far as his cons are concerned, the biggest one is his defensive awareness. Everybody that has scouted Hachimura has the same concerns about that, about his awareness on the floor, that there are moments there, despite all the athleticism and everything else that he has, that he just kind of spaces out. He's not quite sure where to move as the ball is swinging around the court. And you can see it on possessions where the ball moves, he's kind of still on his guy or fails to shed over to another opponent. And that's a problem, because obviously it could lead to an open basket or a drive to the hoop, et cetera. There's not, maybe it's the lack of overall help defense at the collegiate level, but either way, he does not contribute to it because of the quote-unquote lack of awareness. He's not a great passer either. He's a solid passer. Like, he can do it when he's standstill, but when he's on the move driving to the hoop, not great at playmaking for others or finding cutters as they're cutting to the hoop if he's already in motion. And that's problematic as well because, as we know, so many passes and assists at the NBA level come from when you're on the move. And if that's a problem, it may not translate at the NBA level. His first step. Now, the first step thing, I've seen people really, really high on his athletics, his burst on his first step, and I've also seen some people kind of criticize it. The It seems like most people tend to think that it's on the slower side. I didn't personally have any, you know, hard time with it. I thought it was fine. I thought it wasn't explosive necessarily, but maybe you're looking for this incredible burst. But I think the potential's there. I think the problem is, you know, we're looking at a player, to me, that's almost like Justice Winslow. He has a quick first step, but maybe he's not necessarily explosive when it comes to the NBA game. He was great at the collegiate level, so I don't know. I'm having a hard time thinking whether or not Rui is going to actually be able to make it at the NBA level, but I personally feel that he is, and I don't have a problem with the first set. There's also tweening, you know, as a tweener, as far as his position is concerned, because he doesn't really fit either the power forward or small forward. I think he could play both positions pretty well. He's not quick enough for the small forward position, perhaps, but I think he has the athleticism to play both well. Player comps, those were kind of all over the board. Antoine Jameson is one I saw. Wilson Chandler, Paul Millsap even, I guess just the overall size and athleticism there. So that's intriguing to think that he can play, or that he fills both spots like that, and there are comparisons at the NBA level. And then as far as the, I forgot what we were calling it, the success ratio.
Well, I saw a comp from the Ringer's Kevin O'Connor to Jabari Parker and washed Carmelo Anthony.
Yes, okay. Well, I don't know that, about the washed part, but maybe.
Well, I mean, a comparison to Carmelo Anthony would be great. So, but like washed Carmelo Anthony, Jabari Parker, jump shooting, sizable forward who doesn't play defense.
You know, it's not that he doesn't play defense, I think.
Or doesn't play defense well.
Yeah. That's probably fair. Okay. I could see the Jabari comp, to be honest with you, and that's okay. Like I think Jabari could have been a fine player if he had been in a better system coming out of college, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. The guy drafted number 2 overall, Jabari Parker. So I mean, not a bad prospect, but okay. So comparisons, and then so after that we go to, where were you gonna go after that? The upside scale?
Yeah, the upside scale. So
okay. So I remember I wanted to make a quick adjustment to this because last week when we were doing Kevin Porter Jr. and who did you have? I forgot.
Cam Reddish.
Cam Reddish. I said that we were going to rank it into 4 different categories. Bust, contributor, all-star, superstar. You gave me a hard time over bust. So I'm going to switch bust to fringe player. So that could qualify as something similar to like what I was calling a bust. But towards the end of your... end of your bench, or maybe even out of the league. Fringe NBA player. One of those two. Instead of contributor, because I think that's a little vague, high-end bench player starter, you know? Because, like, Andre Iguodala is a bench player, but he's a high-level contributor, right? So, high-end bench player / starter. I think those guys are kind of lumped into the same group. All-star, and then superstar. So, fringe, high-end bench / starter, all-star, superstar, those are the 4 categories.
I'll have our listeners know, you're completely springing this on me. I have no idea if I have to adjust my numbers now to reflect whether or not he's a fringe player. I'm just...
Well, I think it's sort of the same definitions.
I'm busting your chops. I think it's pretty much same thing. And your description of what a bust was
wrong.
Yeah. No, it's not. No, it's not wrong. I feel like a bust and or a fringe player is almost pretty similar, to be honest with you. Like Michael Beasley...
Especially if it's a player that if you're picking that player in the first round... That's not what you want out of it. If you're picking a player in the first round, you want that person to be better than a fringe player. So
that's fair.
What's your percentage on the upside scale starting with fringe for Rui?
I think as a fringe player, he's probably 10%.
Okay.
And I feel a lot of that has to do with the cultural background. Like so much of his ability to translate his game to the NBA level depends on his ability to make adjustments and grow. I think the physical tools are all there. I think it's going to be difficult for him to make those adjustments. If he's capable of doing so, to me, he could be a great player. I actually have him as far as a contributor, pretty solid. I think he's a 30% chance of being a good, solid rotation player.
30%?
Yes.
Okay. Before you move on to all-star and superstar, how concerned are you about his age? He's 21 years old. That's a little old for the draft. You're not concerned.
No, you know what? Because, again, I think so much of it is because he started playing basketball late. This isn't a kid who grew up here in our system here playing AAU ball at 7 or 8, right, going in tournaments and things of that sort. Like, basketball isn't woven into Japanese culture the same way it is here in the United States. So here's this kid who has all the physical tools and athleticism in the world. And he's gone to this point. He's already a success story, in my opinion. And to me, what I think of like players that you want to take a chance on, if you're going to go on and take a chance on a draft because there may not be a surefire player available at 13, you get a guy like Rui, who in my opinion hits on many, many different levels. He's intelligent. He has enough worldly experience that I think he can translate that to being a good locker room presence. He's dedicated because already he's made an incredible journey. Like a lot of the criticism is, well, you know, he didn't play much as a freshman or sophomore. Well, he didn't even speak English. Like, he didn't understand what coaches were telling him as a freshman. And that's a lot to
process. There's shades of Giannis there.
Didn't want to go that far, but I am feeling
that's what we're here for. You got to go that far.
I'm feeling. Like, to be honest.
But he could be, it kind of, well, okay. Let's hit that after your percentages. All-star?
60%.
60%?
Yeah, man.
You are high on this guy.
I think he has all the tools, and it's just going to be a matter of him finding a good system. I know Sam Vecenie has talked about a fit in Miami, and I've got to be honest with you. I love the fit because I think the defensive capability is there. Like, it needs to be taught. It needs to be engaged, and it needs to be laser-like focused. But it can
and
there's, be.
And that's the Heat's coaching staff.
Yeah.
That's what they specialize in.
Yeah, they develop players
to
get them to that
point.
I mean, any other system, he could be a fringe player or perhaps maybe at best a contributor. He could be an all-star, and I think there's a very good chance of it. I even give him a 5% chance of being a superstar because I think the tools are there.
Now you're at 100. You're at 105%.
Am I? Did I go too far? All right, well, no. 30% contributor?
Yeah, 10% fringe.
Okay, I'm sorry.
60% all-star. So let's call it 55% all-star.
Damn, all right, fine.
It's still overall 60%. The guy ends up being an all-star or superstar, which is really,
that's what you want.
That is, according to you, there is a better chance. There is a better than a 50-50 chance at number 13 if Rui was going to be there when the Heat pick, and if the Heat are picking at 13. There is a better than 50-50 chance that Rui Hachimura is an NBA All-Star player. So that's that is very high praise from you. Now, I want to go back to a couple things we hit on throughout here before we move on to my prospect who I scouted. But we talked about the Giannis comparison. Giannis could go anywhere between when you have these guys who kind of started playing late. And the reason I asked you about the age question was because I wanted to kind of open up this part of the conversation where 21 is old for your typical rookie, right? That's considered quote unquote old now. Because you're really only getting 4 or 5 years until that player is supposed to hit their prime. And that's, you know, compared to a 19-year-old player, you can get them on their second contract going into their prime. It's a little bit better. But for a guy like Rui, where he didn't start playing until you said he was 12 years old, and he doesn't have, like, you know, the AAU grind, you know, that baggage coming with him into the NBA. So he's going to be, his prime might not be 26, 27. His prime might be 28, 29, 30, right? Because he's just a little bit of a late bloomer,
right?
Because he picked up the game so late. So that set that aside for now. But the Jabari Parker washed Carmelo Anthony comparisons were really interesting to me because washed Carmelo Anthony is bad on defense because he doesn't want to play defense. Jabari Parker has come out and said, I don't play defense. He just doesn't. It's not his thing. That's not the thing that he's going to do. It doesn't sound like Rui is that. He is slow on the uptick because he's so new to the game of basketball. But it's not for a lack of wanting. It's not for a lack of trying. It's just that he needs to progress a lot on that end, right?
That's my feeling on it. I think others as well. I feel like if you're going to draft a player like him, he's an investment, and you have to invest in him fully and make sure that, one, the team is already deep enough where there aren't these unrealistic expectations for him as a rookie to come in and produce right away and be an immediate impact player. That may not happen, and that's okay. Like, I don't know. Like, we're talking about Pascal Siakam being a future all-star, and maybe that's, you know, incredibly high praise, but he wasn't even a rotation player in his first year in the league.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it takes players some time to grow and expand, and I think there's potential there, and that's what you really want to try and develop as best you can. And so you get a good system like Miami's, you get a team with depth already where there are no unrealistic expectations, and you give them a chance, maybe even hire a translator, somebody like that can really help you unlock your talents and your athleticism, etc., and you have a good chance at succeeding at a star level.
So I'm going to, if I were going to do this, if I had to scout really, I'd probably give him a little bit higher on the fringe scale. Okay. Only because it could just completely submarine for him. And not, it is tough. I mean, what they are asking him to do, to go from Japan to Spokane, Washington to the NBA mm-hmm. within a matter of a few years, is really, really hard to do. And we just don't know how people react to that. So I would probably go a little bit higher on the fringe just because of that risk.
Yeah.
But I like everything that you're talking about. I mean, this could be anywhere between, I mean, Giannis to, who's that Japanese guy? Yi Jalang? Jalang?
Oh, he's Chinese.
Chinese, I'm sorry. Yeah. It could be, that was a similar situation though. Pick, just like Giannis, giant frame, right? Just looks the part of an NBA player. Good athleticism, good skills and raw tools. Just didn't work.
I think
for Giannis it did.
Yeah, I think as popular as basketball is in China, I don't know that Yi Yinlang ever like loved the game as much as like other players do. And I think you see that in a lot of big men, is they're big, and so the expectation is you're going to go out there and play at a high level.
Just go play basketball.
And he wasn't ready for the kind of cliquish nature that we've both seen in locker rooms. Right. And it's hard, for a player that has a hard time speaking English. At least Rui had the collegiate experience. Like, his nickname is Louis.
That's a good point.
Because he had a hard time, and this is somewhat stereotypical, he had a hard time pronouncing R's and L's. So when he was telling people his name, they called him Louis. But even that, like, going back a little further, and maybe this is too deep, like, he experienced incredible racism being, a biracial child in Japan where he had a Japanese mother.
That's similar to the Giannis story, right?
Yeah, I think that's
fueling. Not to keep connecting the dots, but yeah, I think that fuels a player. Okay, so we like Rui. You like him as a fit at number 13 if the Heat were going to take him. You're in on Rui. He's pretty high, it sounds like, on your draft board.
Yes, I'd say that's fair.
So we like him. Okay, so that's what we're doing here, right? We're constructing the Heat's draft board, what we think it should look like. We are high on Rui. He is high up on our board. You would be comfortable taking him at 13, obviously, depending on everybody else who's there.
I would.
I assigned myself Kobe White, the freshman guard out of the University of North Carolina. Very different background, very different kind of prospect than Rui. We're going to talk about that next after the break. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Let's talk about ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/LockedOn. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one, spotlights the top candidates, and so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/LockedOn. That's ZipRecruiter.com/LockedOn, ZipRecruiter.com/LockedOn. I feel like, David, the Heat could use ZipRecruiter to find Rui, because these are the new success stories, right? You go international, you find the guy who hasn't played basketball until he was 15 years old or whatever, and he's got all these raw talents, he's got all these skills that you're looking for to fill your need. I mean, ZipRecruiter would have found Rui.
Without a doubt. And they know the ins and outs of your organization so that they can find the right person to fit all your needs.
ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. All right, David, so I had Kobe White, freshman guard, University of North Carolina, and just some really quick background. The reason I picked Kobe here, I've got my Kelly Oubre man crush, draft crush of the year every draft, right?
Yes.
Last year, or 2 years ago, it was Donovan Mitchell. Mm. The year before that, it was Kelly Oubre. Those years, the Kelly Oubre year, the Heat ended up getting Justice Winslow because he slid in the draft. The Donovan Mitchell year, Donovan goes one pick before Miami picks. They end up with Bam Adebayo. Very happy with Justice. Very happy with Bam. But that's just some background. I thought Kobe White was going to be my Kelly Oubre draft crush of the year. I was very, very close. I like everything I see. He's got a little bit of a gunner mentality, which I like. Mm-hmm. If there's any consistent thread with my draft crushes, they have a gunner mentality. Afro, it matters. The aesthetics, I think that there's a swagger to him.
Style.
All that stuff matters. I'm not sure I'm there yet.
Wow.
All right, so let's get into this. So the thing, the one-liner with Coby White is fast-paced scoring guard who isn't afraid to pull up from anywhere. He's 19 years old, 6'5", 185 pounds, a 6'4" wingspan. It's a little short. He's tall. He's big at his position at 6'5", but you'd want a little bit more out of that wingspan at 6'4". Going into the stats here, 16-1 point. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm curious. Is the height, like, including the afro?
It is not.
Are you sure? Because I feel like that's probably part of the problem, is that he's probably, like, 6'3", with 2 inches of hair at least. And then they're like, oh, he's got a...
Oh, he's got a solid, like, there's a... He might be 7'5", if you included the afro.
Okay. Fair enough.
His stats, 16.1 points per game, 3.5 rebounds, 4.1 assists. Had a true shooting percentage of 55.6, which is pretty good. And then the key stat here to me, other than the 16 points per game and the 4 assists, he took 233 three-pointers in college. That is a good sample size. 233 three-pointers in college. Made 82 of them, so 35.2% from three-point range. He was also an 80% free throw shooter. So, good shooter. That's basically what I'm saying. Other pros for him, other than being a good shooter, flashes some drive and kick ability. We'll get into that a little bit more a little bit later. He's a productive scorer, even though he does tend... Like, the production is there on paper. He just gets a lot of them in bunches. So you can read that as a pro or a con. I guess it depends on what you're scouting him for. If you wanted him to be your lead scorer, probably a con. But if you're just trying to get a little bit of a scoring boost in the middle of the first round, that's probably a pro, because you don't want him playing 35 minutes a game. You want him playing 15 minutes a game, and you want him to just score in bunches in those 15 minutes. So productive scorer, but scores in bunches. He gets downhill really quickly, and this is why fast-paced scoring guard, you get him the ball on the inbound, and he just takes off running towards the rim. He's just a downhill guy. Really efficient shooting off the catch. That's where he's best. Not great off the dribble, though. Mm-hmm. But really, really good set feet off the catch, you know, just a catch and shoot kind of guy. There's a lot of value in that in today's NBA. Like I said, good size for really either guard spot. He is a combo guard. He's being scouted that way. He can play point guard or shooting guard. And then just the confidence. Again, he's got that swagger. He's got that confidence, and you like that. So those are the pros. The cons. He's got a really questionable handle. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen it talked about too much, but not a lot of dribble moves. He's kind of got one crossover going into a step back. It seems to be his pet move, but there's not a whole lot of creativity there. I will be interested to see what, and this is going to sound really like, this is going to sound dumb. I want to know what his hand size is, because on the gather, he tends to get a little sloppy. Whether it's on the gather going into a layup or, like, you know, gathering into a pass, he gets a little sloppy, and a lot of times the ball will either get knocked away from him or the ball will just slip out of his hands. If he's going downhill, he almost plays too fast for himself sometimes. Mm. And that is a really big concern for me, because you see a lot of that coming. A lot of his sloppiness comes out of that gather. It just seems like the ball will just, like, fly off the side of his hand sometimes.
Is he like a Colin Sexton type, or you think Sexton is more polished as a ball handler?
He's a little I don't actually like the Sexton comparison. Okay. Because Sexton wasn't as good as an outside shooter, but he's probably a better ball handler in college and a better defender. Okay, so questionable handle, a little bit of a funky release too coming out of the gather, especially when he's dribbling off, if he's shooting off the dribble. Catch and shoot, it's not as big of a deal. Not an elite shooter, more of a volume shooter. He can be an elite shooter, but he's not, I wouldn't say he's an elite kind of shooter. 80% free throws is pretty good, but he's not shooting 90% from the line either. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He lacks explosiveness around the rim, and he just forces things. And so that's the other side of the coin of that confidence. He does tend to force things a little bit, which is, you know, young 19-year-old point guard, he's going to force things a little bit. The main comparison that I have is Jamal Murray.
Okay.
I think a lot of Heat fans would be happy with Jamal Murray now, but Jamal Murray also, like, there was a, his risk profile was sort of hit or miss. And I think it worked out in Denver because Jamal Murray is playing off of Nikola Jokic. I think Coby White needs a similar situation. I don't want him leading the offense. If Coby White's leading your offense, you're going to have a bad offense. That's point blank. That's the case. But if he's playing off of somebody, I think he could really thrive in a good situation. So Any questions before I go to the upside scale?
Well, who do you envision him playing off of in Miami's roster?
Okay, that's a good question. So if he were to play off of somebody in Miami, I don't know that they certainly do not have a Nikola Jokic-type presence, but he does fit well in that dribble handoff type of thing. So whether it's Kelly Olynyk or Bam Adebayo running it, just whoever you have facilitating in that dribble handoff stuff, I think you could basically put him in the Wayne Ellington spot and it would work almost immediately.
You think he's
that kind of shooter? Almost immediately. Yeah, I think his advanced, or not advanced stats, but his stats specific to catch and shoot are off the charts. And I actually, for whatever reason, didn't write them down, but they're really good. It's just that 3-point percentage at 35% is that low only because he forces so many things off the dribble. Like he'll try the James Harden step back several times a game. And he doesn't convert that at a good rate, but he is shooting above 40% on catch and shoot, and I think you can do that right away. So you can have him come off of the dribble handoffs there a little bit and do that, or you can have him he's really good from the corners, you know, if you have Dion or Goran Dragic or Winslow or even Josh Richardson doing the driving kick, kicking out to Kobe, I think that makes sense too.
Interesting.
And on a team that does not have really a true point guard, unless we want to make Justice Winslow a true point guard, which it sounds like the Heat are reluctant to do so, he fits in just balanced offensive scoring attack where, all right, you get the ball, driving kick, swing, blah, blah, blah. You know, not one player might be leading things, but he's, again, able to play off of somebody, but also play on the ball a little bit like Goran Dragic. I almost made the Goran Dragic comp, but I didn't love it because he's not as crafty and he's not as good as a ball handler as Dragic. So I'll stick with the Jamal Murray, because he also has the Jamal Murray confidence too that can it could be a huge gain for you in a game, right? It could be a huge value add, but it could also be a major detriment if he gets a little too overconfident.
Without a doubt. We've seen both on display during the playoffs.
Out of Jamal Murray, yeah, absolutely. And again, Jamal Murray is the idea of a player I like. Gunner mentality, doesn't really care if the ball goes in or not. He's going to shoot it anyway. Mm-hmm. I like that about Kobe White, but to get into the upside scale, there are some concerns. I have him as a 10% fringe player. I just think at the end of the day, his shooting will be enough, and he's got enough size where he's not tiny, right? Like, he will be able to stay in front of people. So defensively, I feel like he could be good enough. So at the very least, I think there's a 10% chance he'll be fringe, which to me I thought was pretty low. 60% that he is a high-end bench/starter guy. So I think this is probably where he ends up.
Right.
Which is good, especially if you're picking at 13. That's really good. Guy who's going to shoot. He's not going to be your main guy every night, but he'll show up out of 82 games in the season. He'll be there for 41 of them, and you're going to have a really good chance to win those 41 games. All-star, I had that at 25%, and superstar at 5%, and not to me. The superstar seemed a little high to me at 5%.
Yeah.
I might even go 28% all-star, 2%. And the only reason I go that high on the all-star is because the things he does well are so important in today's game. And that's really the biggest benefit to him, right? Is if he is able to hone that Jamal Murray style. Like, you would say Jamal Murray is probably going to be at that all-star level by the time he hits his prime. He's still really young.
He can play in an all-star game or two. I mean, I don't see him being a perennial all-star anytime soon, but I mean...
Perennial all-star, I think we would just... That would be superstar,
yeah,
right?
I
don't know.
Yeah.
So Jamal Murray is probably that all-star. He's probably poised to be in that all-star level. So I would give him... I would say there's a 60% chance that he's just a good player, 25% chance, or better, maybe a little bit better, only because his skill set is important in today's game, that he's an all-star/superstar type player. So that's where I'm at.
So he sounds like a good player, but somewhat incomplete overall as a guard. How's his burst and speed?
It's good. He's got a really great first step, and he's got a really good burst. But again, I think he plays too fast for his handle. And that, to me, is the Kobe White thing. To me, look, if you are going to be an elite shooter coming out of college, that's going to be your calling card. And for Kobe White, his calling card is shooting. Okay, that's not enough for me. Because Anthony Morrow was an awesome three-point shooter, but he's out of the league.
That's all he did.
I know that shooting is important, but you have to do one other thing pretty good. I don't know what that other thing for Kobe White is. Other than the fact that he's 6'5", and that he runs fast. But, I think we're going to hear a lot about his top-end speed going into the draft and through the scouting process. I think it's going to get overblown. I think it's going to get overblown a lot because people are obsessed right now with De'Aaron Fox, right?
Yeah.
But the thing about De'Aaron Fox is he has a killer handle.
Right.
And a much better handle than Kobe White does.
He can explode the handle to go with it. If you can't control the ball while you're moving at that velocity, what does it matter if you can...
And he so often will just dribble it off his knee.
Right.
Like, he quite literally runs too fast for his own handle sometimes. Oftentimes. The speed is there, so if he can develop the handle, okay, now you've got something. You combine the handle with the speed, you've got something there. But right now he doesn't have it. I don't know that he's ever going to have it. Again, and that's why I want to go back. He might have small hands. And so if he's one of these small hands guys, that could be a real detriment to him.
And there is no explanation in other scouting reports or anything like this? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, aside from what you saw, like...
He's not going to have his... I have not seen why... Like, I've heard... I don't think people paid enough attention to it.
Really?
Because he is so often just, like, pulling up from deep. Like, he's not handling the ball so much at UNC that right. it's really noticeable. But when you do notice it, it's very noticeable. Like, when it's there, it was very noticeable. So, obviously he's not going to have his hands measured until the combine. So, we'll see. So, that's something I've got pinned, right? That's something I'm going to be looking at. Other than that, I don't know what he does well. He's not, you know, he can get creative with the pass.
But
he kind of does that fake no-look thing.
Could he be a J.J. Redick type? Is he crafty enough to move off screens like that? Because Redick isn't asked to handle the ball.
I think he is. He could be a Redick type.
Short arm, too. I mean.
Kind of big, though, big for their size. Yeah, I actually like the J.J. Redick comparison. There might be a little bit more just. I mean, Redick actually has turned into a decent pick and roll player.
Yeah.
Like, running the pick and roll throughout the. So, J.J. Redick actually, like, kind of bigger than you think. Kobe White, I think, is. He'd have to add, you know, probably 20 pounds of muscle, but I think he could. I think he certainly has the frame to do it. So, yeah, J.J. Redick would be good. I think that's a fair comparison. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's another player that took some time to develop and had to find the right system and, you know, get credit to Stan Van Gundy for putting other players around him that could kind of unlock what Redick does well.
So I think he's a fit for Miami at 13. Again, if there's a 60% chance that he is a contributor, that's a good pick. That's a good player at 13. I said this to Kevin Porter Jr. that the Heat have so many of these guys already.
Right.
High floor kind of guys. I think he is a high floor guy. I kind of want to go with the swing for the fences. And for that, I think for the first 2 years, Kobe White will be a much better player than Rui Hachimura.
Yeah.
But Rui Hachimura has such a higher ceiling, greater chance to maybe hit on that one that I would really consider it if those two were on the board at the same time. And I don't know, between the two guards that I scouted, Kobe White, and then on last week's episode, Kevin Porter Jr., most people have Kobe. I mean, almost everybody has Kobe White over Kevin Porter Jr.
You're not there,
but I do. I don't know. I don't know who I would. If I'm looking for somebody with higher upside who can with greater chance of hitting that upside, I almost think KPJ might be a better pick if you really want to swing for the fences. But that's where I'm at right now.
The thing is, then you could say he can be an immediate impact player, right? Well, not impact player. He can be an immediate contributor. Like, it seems more likely that of all the guys that we've talked, maybe with the exception of Reddish, that White could be a guy who could have an immediate contribution because of his
shooting. Yeah, more so than anybody else we've scouted. Yeah, like day one,
you're right.
He can come off of a screen and hit a three-pointer.
Probably if it's a bad team, too. I mean, if he's a guy who fits onto a bad team, like, he can get the kind of run necessary where he could just...
I think he would fit better on a team like Miami that is kind of has other pieces in place and just needs you to do this one thing. And just go do this one thing well for a couple of years.
I disagree with that because then especially in Miami's case, it's like you're not going to get any kind of playing time unless you're a more well-rounded player, especially if you can contribute defensively. And while he has some potential defensively, like, I mean, I don't know that he would be able to do enough on that side to earn the kind of playing time and to earn Spoelstra's trust. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like that's more of a...
Well, if he could develop with, you know, because Miami has, and depending on what happens with Juwan Howard, obviously, but they have good player personnel coaches, player development coaches. Like, it's going to be behind the scenes where he gets better.
Sure.
Like, I'm looking at his name over here. Kobe White is going to have to put in a lot of work by himself, but he's also going to need a coaching staff. And I do think if you put him in like a Colin Sexton type of role, he'll struggle. Like, you could submarine that confidence that is such a pro right now. Mm-hmm. You could really put that at risk if you make him your starting point guard. So I wouldn't want to see him in that sort of situation. I'd want to see him in a situation where he could play off the ball and just sort of take his time to get up to speed and develop some of these other more raw parts of his game. But we've spent enough time on Coby White. Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk about some Game of Thrones after the break. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Thank you to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. You could support them and support us by going to ZipRecruiter.com/LockedOn. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're on iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us. This is the part of the show on Mondays where we talk about Game of Thrones. No more basketball stuff from here on out, so if you're not interested in listening to Game of Thrones talk or don't want any spoilers, end the show right here. You're not going to miss anything. We'll catch you tomorrow with our final exit interview, and thank you for listening. David, let's get into the Game of Thrones, because episode 4 of this season, we're coming off of the Long Night episode, the big war, Arya's a hero, all this stuff is happening. We open up to this, to basically the funeral part of the show, and you know, we say goodbye to all the characters. I thought that was an interesting way to open the show, because you're coming off this high of Arya defeating the Night King, and then it brings you back. It starts you with this somber kind of reminder that, okay, these guys, like, there's a bunch of dudes that died, and we're gonna start here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's where we left off the last time, the death of Jorah Mormont, and so it kind of starts off with a shot of his face, and Daenerys stands over, and we're ready to light the funeral pyre. Yeah, your boy Ed got a little screen time there.
Yeah, I was excited about that.
You know, just another way to kind of reconnect from last week and say, you know, I forgot, or not forgot, but just to kind of remember these major characters and Ed that died along the way.
Major characters and Ed. Then we go into this drunken hookup party, basically. A lot of stuff happens. They're kind of sitting around. It's, you know,
well, it starts off kind of off a little bit morbidly, because everybody's still, they're recovering. I mean, the hell, they just lost 90% of their friends and family, and whatever's left, and the survivors are kind of just, you know, they're kind of just quietly enjoying their mead and wine and
nothing,
whatever food.
Nothing that a nice Dornish red won't fix, David.
Apparently, yeah. But then the Gendry is, you know, initiated to full Baratheon status, no longer a bastard son of Robert Baratheon.
He's been given Storm's End to rule over, and then shoots his shot with Arya right away. Painful. I think he read the whole situation wrong.
You know, Arya remains, no, she's predictable, but also difficult for anybody on the outside. It doesn't, for people who's like us, the viewer, who sees her and her transformation, we totally understand that she's become a person without a true identity, really. She could be anybody. But for people who are connected to her, like her family or in Gendry in some way, you know, it's hard to understand that Arya can disconnect so completely from what most people take for granted as a function of human nature. And so whatever they share that first time before this incredible death, you know, she didn't want to have any kind of part of it. You know, it's like, oh, sorry, not interested. Thanks, I really appreciate it. You're really good. It's not you, it's me. I got to get going.
I'm not a lady. I've never been a lady. That's not my style. That's not how I roll. She's got people on her list still, right? I mean, she's, so to stick to Arya now, she's heading off to King's Landing with the Hound, right? And so that'll be fun, that little trip there, I guess. That's one of our favorite duos in show history. So we get that. And then speaking of favorite duos in show history, Brienne and Jaime finally sealing the deal on this tension that's been building up for basically half of as long as this show has been running. And then Jaime dips. What do you think's going on with that? Because he, you know, they do the thing. Then he basically takes off. He starts putting the stuff on his horse or whatever happens in that situation. And he's about to ride off and go back to King's Landing to meet up with Cersei. Do we think that he is, and he kind of tells it like, look, I've basically killed 1,000 people for Cersei. Like, I always end up going back to Cersei. I've got to leave. I got to go back to Cersei. Do we think he is going back to reconnect with Cersei, or do we think that he's going back basically to end things with Cersei, to kill Cersei maybe even, in order to really put the old Jaime to bed?
I'm kind of leaning towards the latter. Like, I'm not sure why he had to make that serious break. Maybe he felt like he couldn't share his true intentions without hurting her or having Bronn on his tail, another character that we haven't seen in a couple episodes. So I feel like you can't go through this process. I know some people have said that the redemption arc for Jamie was kind of overblown and that maybe they never really bought into it, but I don't think you go through five seasons of being different and better and having a unique, an expounded, you know, an interpretation of world events, and then all of a sudden go, you know what, I realize after really having this incredible battle where we were saving all of humanity, and I go, you know what, I'd rather just go back to banging my sister.
Yeah, one big battle and a nice lay later, and you're just like, all right, I'm going to redo all this progress I've made? That doesn't make any sense.
It does, like, not.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think this is a I think this was a pitch that's going to curve from the writers here. I do think that we're supposed to think that Jamie broke bad, but I think he's going to end up being the hero at the end. Or maybe not the hero. It might be too strong of a word, but it's not going to be as bad as we think. That's at least maybe that's what I'm hoping for. I don't know.
I think he's destined to be the one who kills Cersei.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Okay, so a couple things stood out here. We said bye-bye to Rhaegal and Missandei. That was sad. Definitely would not have bet on Missandei outliving Grey Worm. That was, I mean, you probably had minus 750 odds on that one. I mean, you probably could have won a lot of money on that. But that's almost worse for Grey Worm, right? Like, that is the worst. Like, Grey Worm would have rather obviously died before Missandei did, but then now he's got to live. He saw, you know, her get
well, he did. He had his back turned. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He the nick of time there. But the one thing that I really want to talk about is, to me, with the best part, there was a lot that happened. We lost a dragon. There was boats. There was stuff happening there. We got the return of Cersei. All this stuff was happening. But the more interesting thing to me was sort of the behind-the-scenes thing. And that's what I've always liked the most about Game of Thrones, was all of the stuff that happens in the dark rooms, the conversations that happen there, and we finally
struggles, the exchange of information and secrets. Like, everybody's kind of disappointed in this episode, or a lot of people are, although you and I don't feel that way.
No,
but you had this, you know, seasons of build up towards this incredible battle with the Night King that I feel lived up to all expectations, and in our opinion, I think. And then this is a step, not necessarily back, but a sideways step to another aspect of the show, which works really well. Which is,
got back to our roots here.
Yeah, I mean, finding out, look, like, John has issues now with Dany. It's clear that even in the post-battle, they're not on the same page. Dany's upset and concerned about his true, you know, his claim to the throne. She asks him not to reveal his secret, is what he does. He reveals it right away. And then from there, the secret's already started to grow, from just telling Sansa and Arya to all of a sudden Tyrion knows, and now Varys knows.
Sansa tells Tyrion knows Varys, and Varys says it's not a secret anymore, it's information.
Right, right. And that's the thing. We've seen that kind of snowball frequently over the course of the show, and you know, even without Littlefinger in the picture, the secret mongers, Varys and Tyrion, they do a really, really good job of it, and that's a precious commodity in Winterfell, and, I'm sorry, in all of Westeros.
So Tyrion and Varys now are kind of...
at odds?
They're a little bit at odds, but they want to be on the same team, where... I don't know that that's necessarily the case with John and Dany. Like, John wants to be on the same team, but Dany only wants, like...
Where do you feel...
Dany wants to be Kobe.
Where do you feel on the point... Like, the dividing line... Well, the dividing line here is that Dany is going to go in there and say, no, I have to go in now, take King's Landing right away, and if that costs me a couple thousand villagers along the way, well, so be it. And Varys is like, well, I've always protected the realm, even from, you know, tyrants. Tyrion still believes in Dany. And he wants Dany and John to be co-leaders. Where do you feel on this? Where do you stand? Is Dany right? Is she being kind of bullheaded? Or is this just another abrupt shift in her personality?
So first of all, Dany is... I've been out on Dany for two seasons.
There you go. Wow.
She's no Ramsay Bolton, that's for sure. Tyrion is kind of he's sort of the conscience of the viewers right now. Like, all the viewers... Because he's the one proposing, like, hey, maybe John and Dany can rule together, get married, happy ending, everybody's happy. Like, what's the problem with that? And Varys is basically the one kiboshing the whole... He's like, are you crazy?
Yeah,
like,
it's not gonna work.
Dany would never do that. And Tyrion's like, yeah, but, you know, maybe John could, you know, like, maybe John can kind of curb worst instincts and all these things. Varys is like, you're an idiot. And that's kind of, I think, anybody who's been a fan of the show has kind of gone down that road in their own head or around the water cooler at the office. They've been like, well, maybe they can rule together. And you can then you kind of think about how the X's and O's would have to work out. And you're like, no, there's no way. There's just no way they can work together. There's going to have to be a clash here. Varys is very obviously going to side with John, you know, but he's not an insane person. He's not going to just go out and call out Danny and be like, I'm with John now. You know, he's going to figure out some sly backroom way to do stuff. But Tyrion is kind of dealing with this internal conflict that I think a lot of viewers are also dealing with, and that we're kind of like Danny, who has been such a badass character for the entire show, kind of sucks now and kind of is going to the dark side a little bit now, and we're going to have to deal with some real questions with her.
I don't see it quite so extreme as her going to the dark side, but I mean, for 8 years, we've kind of believed that she is supposed to be the person sitting atop the throne. We've seen her journey. And now all of a sudden we're kind of forced to take this step back and go, well, maybe she isn't the best candidate. Maybe it is John all along. And Varys brings up a really good point that all these people who have previously held the throne always wanted it. Maybe the best leader is actually somebody who doesn't want it, like John. And so, I'm curious to see how it plays out. I don't like the conflict between the two, but I mean, between Varys and Tyrion, nor do I like it between John and Danny. It doesn't bode well for the ending of the show. It seems like it's probably leading up to one of the two dying.
Yes.
And whoever survives, I guess, probably being a broken shell of themselves.
Yeah, it's going to suck for one of those guys.
nice.
We got two more episodes left. We'll see what happens. We'll be back tomorrow with our final exit interview of our exit interview series. Thanks for listening. You can connect with us on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or email us at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.